We read again in the book of Psalms, Psalm number 39, the 39th Psalm. I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle, while the wicked is before me. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace, even from good, and my sorrow was stirred. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then spake I with my tongue, Lord, make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days what it is, that I may know how frail I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, and mine age is as nothing before thee. Verily, every man at his best state is altogether vanity. Surely every man walketh in a vain show. Surely they are disquieted in vain. He heapeth up riches and knoweth not who shall gather them. And now, Lord, what wait I for? My hope is in thee. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I was dumb. I opened not my mouth because thou didst it. That is to say, because thou didst bring this distress upon me. Thou didst it. Remove thy stroke away from me. I am consumed by the blow of thine hand. When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Surely every man is vanity. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner, as all my fathers were. O spare me, that I may recover strength before I go hence and be no more. Amen. May God bless unto us the reading of his holy word. Now let us turn to the 39th Psalm. Psalm number 39. Some commentators think, and I believe not without reason, that the 39th Psalm is connected with the previous one and is a kind of sequel to it. And there's a good deal to be said for this view. For one thing, there's a similarity of thought between verses 13 and 14 of last Sunday's psalm, but I as a deaf man heard not, and I was as a dumb man that openeth not his mouth. Thus I was as a man that heareth not, and in whose mouth are no reproofs. Connection between these verses in Psalm 38 and the second verse of 39. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace. My sorrow was stirred. And certainly the general circumstances of the two psalms are those of sorrow and affliction. And if there is a connection, as it seems there is, then we would expect a development of thought from the one to the other. And I think we do see that, because the 39th psalm isn't so dark a psalm as the 38th. It's just as if David had learned from his earlier experience and was putting what he had learned into practice in this experience of distress. And when you do that, when you put into practice what you learn from the Word of God, then light comes into the darkness. As the psalmist says elsewhere in the 119th psalm, the entrance of thy words giveth light. And so in Psalm 39, the atmosphere is not quite as dark as in the previous psalm. But he's in circumstances of trial just before, and he's acutely conscious of his trial and his affliction, and it's in these circumstances that he says what he does in verses 1 and 2. I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. I was dumb with silence. I held my peace. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, in the midst of his affliction, he is conscious of the very real temptation to utter hot and angry recriminations against God and bitter complaints against God for allowing the distress and trial to have come upon him and to continue. That's what he's facing here. And it's because he's conscious of these temptations to let hot, angry words pour out, "Oh God, why have you done this to me? It's not fair of you, God." It's so human, isn't it? It's because of that temptation that he says this. He is determined to resist it. He's determined not to let these angry, hot words pour out. Now, this, for a start, shows the temper of the psalm. Because it means that there's a fighting spirit about it. And it lends to it a certain vigor that's very wholesome. Now notice what he says in verse 1. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. That is to say, it is the presence of the wicked, his foes, the enemies of the truth of God, that imposes the silence upon his lips. Now that's very telling. But it's precisely when we're under pressure that hasty, ill-advised words sometimes do spill out in the hearing of the ungodly. Words that we immediately regret very bitterly afterwards. We didn't mean to say them, especially in front of the people who have no time for religion. Because we knew that they would say, "That's your Christian. Look at him now under pressure. That's your Christian." That's the setting of the psalm. It's precisely at this point that danger arises. We didn't mean to say these words, but we said them for all that, and they brought shame on the name that we bear. And the ungodly weren't slow to make capital out of them. Now you see how worthy David's sentiment is here. I won't let a word escape my lips in the presence of the ungodly. A very commendable attitude. You see, it's what we are and what we're seen to be when we're under pressure that has a habit of coming out in word and attitude and can very often mar our testimony and bring real shame upon the name of the Lord. And that's the real testing for our witness. And it's there that the outside world watches us so carefully and keenly. And this is something very practical that we can learn from the psalmist. Put a watch on your lips when you're under pressure, because there are people watching you, watching to see how real your Christianity is, watching to see just how real and sincere the faith that you profess is. It's easy to profess faith on the wave, the crest of a wave. But can we profess that same faith and trust in the goodness of God when we're down in the troughs of the wave? David did. I said, I will take heed to my ways that I sin not with my tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. But now, in the next place, notice the effect of that attitude. Notice what happened. I held my peace, verse 2, even from good. Now, that last phrase, even from good, is better translated, and I had no comfort. I held my peace, but it didn't make things any better, but worse. That's what he means. And of course, that's what happens. My sorrow was stirred. Grief suppressed, is grief increased, and the hidden sorrow burned deep down and gnawed at the roots of his being. And that's the force of these words in verse 3. My heart was hot within me while I was musing, the fire burned,
while I was desperately putting a watch on my lips, down here the great fires were burning and gnawing my soul. And the more he kept silence, the more the fire within him was given fuel. And although we can do nothing but commend David for his determination not to give the ungodly any cause to scoff and sneer, we must realize that he managed this only at the expense of an even greater outburst later. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then spake I with my tongue. Then it came out. Then the whole fire erupted like a volcano, and out it all came. But you see, you can't bottle up pent-up feeling. If it is there, it will sooner or later come out, and all the more violently for having been denied its natural expression. Now, there's a great deal for us to learn here. This is a good example, as a matter of fact, of what we were studying on Wednesday evening about the difference between bodily exercise and soul exercise. To set a seal on your lips is one thing, and it's good so far as it goes, but it only has a limited value. The seal must be set in the heart, and it's down there that the work must be done, not on your lips. And there's not much good going to be effected ultimately if you place a seal on your lips, if down in your heart these hot, bitter recriminations are bubbling about, because sooner or later out they'll come, and the explosion will be all the more fierce when it does happen. Well, the question now arises, is what we read in verse 4 onwards, does this represent what burst out when the psalmist did break silence? Then spake I with my tongue, Lord, make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days what it is. Well, I used to think so, because the psalm seemed to read so naturally that way. My heart was hot within me, while I was musing the fire burn. Then it burst out, and I spake with my tongue, Lord, make me to know mine end, and so on. But it's pointed out, you know, by some commentators that these verses, from verse 4 onwards, do not, in fact, constitute an impassioned outburst, but a calm, meditative utterance, full of quiet and noble dignity. One of the great commentators of the past called this the noblest elegy in the whole of Hebrew literature. Lord, make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days what it is, that I may know how frail I am. No, I think we should rather take these words not as what burst out, but as what the psalmist said after he had burst out. In other words, what burst out from that great cauldron of fire isn't recorded for us, and as Alexander McLaren said, didn't deserve to be recorded. A curtain is drawn after the words of verse 3. Then spake I with my mouth. We can well imagine the hot indignation and the bitter complaint that did pour out in the secret place. Now, that's the place, if it's going to burst out, that's where it should burst out, not in front of the enemies of God's people. Take it to the Lord in prayer. In the secret place, pour it out where no enemies could hear. Perhaps he poured it out before those who loved him best. This is a privilege that we sometimes have. We wouldn't say what we do outside, but we can say it in the privacy of the company of those who love us and trust us and know us. Out it comes. And one can almost hear God, after this terrible outburst of pent-up feeling and emotion was poured out before the Lord saying to him, David, doest thou well to be angry? And pointing out to him that perhaps There were purposes in this discipline which he had not seen, but needed to see, that there were lessons for him to learn, that he had not yet learned, but needed to learn. And realizing this at last, with a hot flush of distress and agitation abated, he's now able to see more clearly and think more truly, and so he goes on to pray, "Lord, make me to know mine end, and the measure of my days what it is, that I may know how frail I am." In other words, like Moses, David on this occasion, behind the scenes, spake unadvisedly with his lips. Then he came to himself, and better and nobler thoughts rose up in his heart. And these nobler thoughts are expressed in this beautiful and dignified elegy, "Lord, make me to know mine end." Now, there are a number of different notes struck here in these verses. "Behold, thou hast made my days as a handbreadth, and mine age nothing before thee. Verily, every man is at his best state altogether vanity. Brief life is here our portion." That's the theme. "Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day." David is conscious then, deeply conscious of the mystery of life. And this is especially so in that he's been passing through suffering and affliction. And he asks humbly, not hotly, but humbly now, for light on the agonizing dilemmas that are upon him. "Lord, make me to know." It's always good when a man prays like that. "Make me to know." There's a humility there that promises answer from the Lord. A deep, pervading sense of the insignificance of man's short, brief life as over against the changeless eternity of God. And this threatens to overcome him. But he finds refuge in God. "My hope is in thee. What wait I for? My hope is in thee." And in the resolution of this conflict and debate, the rest of the psalm is occupied, as we shall see. Now, there are three strands, it seems to me, here, and we must take time to disentangle them and study them separately. The first, then, is this all-pervasive consciousness of the brevity of human life, and almost, you might say, the meaninglessness, the mystery of life, as over against the eternity of God. A lifetime looks long, but measured out against God's eternal years, it's as nothing. And that's something that comes home again and again to the human spirit. We sum it up in the way that we sometimes say, "My, doesn't time fly?" We look back to our childhood days. We think of all the things we were going to do in life, and life is behind us already. We haven't begun. The shortness, the brevity of life. This is the thing that was worrying the psalmist. Now, there are several points to be noticed here. In the first place, this is only one side of the picture that we get in the Psalms of David's thoughts on life in this direction. Bear in mind that he's had this same kind of thought before, as he's been contemplating the eternity, the majesty, the greatness of God. In Psalm 8, for example, "When I consider the heavens, the work of thy hands, what is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou visitest him?" But there, you see, in that psalm, that very thought exalted his heart and thrilled him. "How excellent is thy name in all the earth." Adoring wonder. It was mystery in light, not mystery in darkness. That was his reaction. "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" It was pure worship that was evoked from David's heart as he saw his littleness as over against the majesty and greatness of God. And to think that that God loved him. But you see, in this psalm, the very opposite reaction from the same circumstances comes. Now, you get this different reaction yourself. You look at the great vastness of the starlit heavens, and At times, a great sense of wonder and adoration comes to your heart, because you're conscious that that mighty God is so near to you, so wonderful, and you're filled with comfort. The God who made that is well able to control my little destiny, and we're comforted and helped and encouraged. But there are other times when we stand under the same starlit heavens, and a chill and frightening sense of our nothingness and our insignificance comes home to our hearts, and dark doubts that there could be a God who cares. You see, these are opposite reactions from the same set of circumstances. It depends on the mood, put that in inverted commas, the mood of the heart and the circumstances around us. And here in this psalm, it was the darker and more pessimistic note that came home to David's heart. And in the second place, it's only the kind of prayer that we have in verse 4, Lord, make me to know mine end, that can transport us from the one into the other. Only when you can pray like that in faith are you transported from the chill sense of meaninglessness into the rest and security of the people of God. Thirdly, we need to see how relevant this feeling of the psalmist is to present-day thinking and trends and attitudes. For much of the present unrest and disquiet of the human heart, and perhaps especially young hearts, has arisen precisely because of the seeming meaninglessness and futility of life. Life has no purpose. Life has no meaning. Life has no importance for so many people, and that's why so many antisocial forms of behavior keep breaking out as a protest against the meaninglessness and the futility of life. Lord, make me to know mine end. That's the point at which meaning begins to come. That's why David's prayer here is so important and relevant. For he asks God to show him the purpose of life. In fact, and this is the conclusion he comes to, brief as his life is, as over against the eternal years of God, it cannot be in vain if it is linked to the purpose of God. You see, it's possible to serve our day and generation, then fall asleep in the glad consciousness and assurance that life, however brief, has not been in vain. Man's chief end, says the Catechism, is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And a life that is cut off, very young indeed, is not in vain if that life has glorified God in the years that have been given to it. Life can never be in vain when life is linked to the eternal majesty of the purposes of God. And this is what David was struggling to get through to. Lord, make me to know mine end. Let me give you just two examples of this. The saintly Murray McCheen of Dundee, who died before he reached his 30th birthday. And yet, he has left his mark on the devotional life of the church for the past 150 or so years. He didn't live in vain. He liveth long who liveth well. It's not quantity, but quality. That's what matters. That's not to say that you sometimes get quantity and quality together in those to whom God gives many long and useful years. But the point is this, that no life, however short, can be termed vain and meaningless and purposeless if it is linked to the divine purposes of grace. The other example I think of is the story of the Ecuador martyrs, these five young men from America who went to the Auca Indians some years ago and were martyred for the faith of Jesus Christ. all young men, all under 30. Were these lives in vain? This is what one of them, Jim Elliot, once wrote in his diary. He makes his ministers a flame of fire. Am I ignitable? God deliver me from the dread asbestos of other things. Saturate me with the oil of the Spirit, that I may be a flame. But flame is transient, often short-lived. Canst thou bear this, my soul, short life? In me there dwells the spirit of the great short-lived, whose zeal for God's house consumed him. Make me thy fuel, flame of God. And God did, and who shall say that that life was in vain? 20-odd years, and gone, cut off in the flower of young manhood, but not in vain. Not when you can pray, make me to know mine end. And then in verses 7 onwards, we find David's real comfort and consolation. And now, Lord, what wait I for? My hope is in thee. This is the force of the other strand of thought in the psalm. Scholars maintain, you know, that there's not much consciousness of life to come in the Old Testament or in the Psalms as a whole, but I question this very much. But whether it's true or not, whether this life or the life to come is in David's mind, these words apply to both and to either. When a man's hope is in God for this life or the next life, he is related to eternity. And he cannot live in vain, because eternity is fulfilling his purposes in this lifespan. Eternity has come down and invaded these few brief years. Brief life is here our portion. But if eternity has invaded these few years, then they're pregnant with possibility, and they're filled with grace and power. My hope, says David, is in thee. Now, all this, you see, forms the basis and the groundwork of David's experience. And it's this that ensures that the touching prayer in the last part of the psalm will be answered. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. I was dumb, I opened not my mouth, because thou didst it. Remove thy stroke away from me, I am consumed by the blow of thine hand. When thou with rebukes dost correct man for iniquity, thou makest his beauty to consume away like a moth. Surely every man is vanity. Hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger with thee, and a sojourner as all my fathers were. Now, do not forget that David is in trouble and distress, in sorrow, and it may be in sin. This is all around him. And it's this that has provoked the sentiments of the whole psalm. But this is the point. When basic fundamentals get sorted out, as David's basic fundamentals did get sorted out in this psalm, you have a ground on which to stand, and on which you can cry to God in real confidence. When you get the tangle of life's mysteries cleared up, when you see that life has a purpose, however brief it is, and that eternity has laid hold of your life for a purpose, then your sorrows and woes cannot finally overwhelm you. Now, you set this basic knowledge against the pathos in a verse like verse 12. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Give ear unto my cry. Hold not thy peace at my tears, for I am a stranger. The ascending scale of intensity. Hear, give ear, hold not thy peace at my tears. And then, a stranger and a sojourner. One of the commentators points out that here is really a plea to God. Because in the East, a stranger and a traveler had, by long custom, a claim upon the hospitality of any tent that he came to. And what David is claiming here is that He is entitled to the hospitality of God.
Lord, I am a stranger and a sojourner. Therefore, I have a right to your protection and your help. That's the point here. But the great thing, you see, is to have come to an understanding of life, to know our end, and to realize the purpose of our lives. You recall the story of the lost coin, how Jesus told it to illustrate the purpose in men's lives. We're all made for a purpose, brought into the world with a job to do. And when we enter into that good and perfect and acceptable will of God for our lives, it is then that life has meaning and life is fulfilled for us. Ah, well, what about those who do not hope in God? What about those who are chilled in spirit by the inscrutability of God and find no comfort in his greatness and his majesty? What about those for whom life is meaningless? There's only one thing to say. This is the prayer that must be on their lips. Lord, make me to know mine end. Lord, show me the purpose of my life. Because in praying that prayer, we come to the first step which leads to salvation. Because when we're humbling ourselves before the Lord and asking his light, it will never be withheld. For Jesus said, after all, I am the light of the world. He that followeth after me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Ah, this is a very, very human psalm. There's so much of ourselves in it, our own temptations to burst out in time of distress, to let the hot, bitter things welling up in our hearts come pouring out, marring our testimony. We can learn from David to put a watch upon our lips. We can learn from David's outburst, which isn't recorded. We can learn from that too, to pour out our hearts before God and let him deal with our hearts. And particularly under affliction, under the pressure of circumstances, we may learn that God has his own purposes in so leading us, and that he's strong enough to resist our piteous cries until his discipline does its work in our hearts. So often we need to hear him saying, David, doest thou well to be angry? Don't you think that there are lessons that you haven't learned and need to learn in this suffering and in this affliction? And happy is the man who, when he hears that word from the Lord, submits to it and says, Lord, that which I see not, teach thou me, as Job said, and there is much in this psalm to echo the book of Job, make me to know mine end. What is your end in life? Is there meaning in your life? Or do you think ultimately it is futile? Happy is the man who finds that there is an end in life, to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And happy is the man who enters into that enjoyment and into that glorying through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. May God bless his word to us. Amen.